So Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney released his income tax records this morning, and we have found out that he paid $3 million in taxes in 2010, among other things. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, January the 24th, and we'll talk with financial planner Kevin McKinley about taxes and politics for the first segment of our program this morning. And as always, we will welcome your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
So how are you on this fine morning?
I am well. I can trust that you are all healed from your recent illness last week.
That's right. I was coughing away last week at this time. I was hacking through this program with my mic off while you were talking. So
makes for great radio. Just not only the hacking, but also the discussion of the hacking. I think combine that with traffic and weather on the 8s, I think we got a whole hour's worth of show right here.
There we go. But I'm happy to report that the cough is gone and I am feeling fine. And I'm interested in taxes and politics. Mitt Romney did release this morning, and you probably have heard, but a preliminary review of his tax documents to several media outlets early this morning. Mitt Romney earned $21.7 million in 2010 and paid nearly $3 million in taxes, which is a rate of slightly less than 14%. So let's just kind of talk about this dispute over tax statements of presidential candidates to begin with.
Well, that's a standard strategy at this point of the campaign timeline where one candidate, especially when it's down to two stronger rivals, one who sees some political hay to be made, demands that the other challenger release his or her tax returns. And this time it was Newt Gingrich to Mitt Romney. Romney's response was to hem and haw for a long time and make a few sideways comments for it, but he finally did release it today. And these were his 2010 tax returns with some information about 2011's return as well.
So what's your takeaway from these tax records?
Well, he did earn a bunch of money, and he has a lot of it as well. And it's not so much even the money that hurts him, it's his comments that go along with it. He had said previously that I actually only earned in 2010 about $350,000 in speaking fees, not very much. That's about 10 times what the average American makes. That was almost 1%. That income alone actually puts him in the so-called 1%. He has about $190 million to $250 million of net worth, including an IRA, which was put into the phrase of between the IRA is worth between $20 and $100 million, which that's quite a wide range of value. But I understand that because for some people, their brokerage statements can be very difficult to read. So that gap is not surprising. Now, Newt's net worth is about $7 million or so. These numbers are mind-boggling, especially when you compare them to the net worth of the average American, which is per household basis is about $100,000 right now, and that includes home equity, that includes savings, and that includes any retirement plans they have as well.
Yeah, I got to hike my speaking fee up a little bit, I think, too. I get zero for speaking fees, by the way. what advantage do you think that this information of Romney's finances might have for Gingrich?
It's what you mentioned. It's not so much how much money he has. It's how much it's taxed and at what rate. Romney is apparently paying about a 14% rate. And the reason being is that a lot of his income did come from dividends and carried interest from investments that he is profiting from while he was working at Bain Capital, a consulting group that he worked for many years. In 2010, Gingrich says he paid 31% of his $3 million in income and taxes. So the question comes down to who is paying his or her fair share. And again, this is probably going to ring hollow with many Americans, although many Americans do pay even a lower rate on their income in federal income taxes. The average federal income tax rate for American households, according to the Tax Foundation, is about 11% of income each year. But that does not include taxes like Social Security, Medicare, which do end up eating up a larger share of people in the lower and middle incomes bracket. Mitt did bring up a point in this. He said, you know, a lot of my income came from capital gains, which are taxed generally at 15%. And he said, my opponent here, Newt, has brought a proposal on which would have a 0% rate on capital gains. And under Newt's plan, I would pay absolutely no taxes whatsoever.
So I'm just trying to think. Aren't most candidates and politicians wealthier than most of the rest of us?
Much wealthier, and it's been so for a very long time. And if you try to find, you say, I'm only going to vote for a poor or middle-class candidate, especially on the state or the national level, you're going to have a very difficult time finding a candidate. President Obama last year paid about 25% of his income in 2010 in income taxes, federal income taxes. Of course, that was $1.7 million of income alone. The members of Congress right now, about 11% have a net worth greater than $9 million, and there are 249 millionaires of members of Congress. And even the past presidents, President Gore, or Vice President Gore, rather, President Clinton, President Bush, all have net worth anywhere from $20 million to $200 million. And even in past presidents, a website called 24/7 Wall Street did a study where they looked at, tried to assemble the net worth of presidents over time and then adjust it for inflation. And they found that FDR, adjusted for inflation, had about $60 million in net worth. Teddy Roosevelt had about $125 million in net worth. And George Washington, the father of our country, was worth about a half billion with a B dollars in today's money.
Wow. Kevin McKinley, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, personal finance question or a question about money matters, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for our On Your Money email bag. And a listener says that he has reason to believe that his late father had money at a bank that is difficult to find. And he wonders how he can find out if there is a lost account in his father's name. Kevin?
I think this is going to be a much more common occurrence. You've got an older generation, people generally born right before or during the Depression. They're generally a little more secretive about their finances. And then you have banks and credit unions changing names on what seems like an annual basis. And the longer people live, the more likely it is that we're likely to forget where we put money in different types of accounts. The statements become more confusing. So I think a lot of us who live to a ripe old age are going to forget to not only tell our heirs where our money is, but also we're going to forget where it is as well.
Right. And so where should would-be heirs begin looking for this?
The FDIC actually has a database of bank names and credit unions. The National Credit Union Association also has one as well. If you Google bank find, it's one word, B-A-N-K-F-I-N-D, and we'll have a link up to these websites at onyourmoney.com. Then you can search for the institution and see what happened to it, what it evolved to, or if it just flat out went out of business and which bank took over its assets, and then what the successor bank or lending institution's contact information is.
And then what should you do?
You call the institution up and you ask within the name of the person, you say, do you have any deposit boxes and accounts in these people's names? Regulators have said that what's common is they said, no, the people did have an account here one time, but they closed the account and moved the money elsewhere. But the institution may not have a record of it. And if that's the case, you might want to check and see if the institution actually couldn't find, in this case, his late father, and transferred the money over to an abandoned property fund that usually is governed by most states.
So where do you find out where your abandoned property fund is?
There are a couple different sites. You should check these anyway for not only yourself, but for long-lost heirs, to see if they have any long-lost money for you. But go to unclaimed.org and missingmoney.org, unclaimed.org and missingmoney.org. And again, we'll have links up to these websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Yeah, I thought I might have passed this along to you before, Kevin, but I did, following my father's death many years ago, received a letter in the mail about unclaimed property, but it was through, I think, a for-profit service that wanted to get this money for me and for a percentage of it. But it just clued me in that it was available, and I was able to claim that money all by myself. So that's
It's very common. These organizations go through these databases themselves, try to contact people and say, hey, we may have some money for you and someone in your name. If you sign here, which is usually a promise either to pay us a flat fee or to pay us a percentage of whatever money we recover for you, we'll go ahead and tell you about it. Well, you're much better off just going to these websites first and seeing if you can find the information for yourself.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner. He is managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and we have an open line for you. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tim emails, student loans, help. My monthly payments and interest rates are too high. How do I consolidate and refinance at a lower rate?
There are a couple different options. If they are federal student loans, he can go to IBRinfo.org, IBRinfo.org, and that is an income-based repayment plan that if your income is too low, you can make payments that are lower based on your income, and if you keep those payments current for several years, they'll actually forgive whatever debt you have outstanding. In terms of private loans, it's a little trickier. You should go to your first primary lender first and see what kind of offers they have, explain the situation, and definitely extend it out as long as you possibly can. And with as low a rate as you possibly can. You want to get this money paid off quickly, obviously, but you want to give yourself the freedom to stay current on the loans with as low of payment as you possibly can.
Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, Kevin will have some advice on whether we should hurry up or wait when it comes to mortgage refinancing, and some tips to shop online safely, and more answers to your personal finance questions. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you will join us for live coverage of the State of the Union address and the Republican response tonight, starting at 8 here on the Ideas Network. And then tomorrow morning, all morning long, from 6 until 9 anyway, we will have all sorts of reaction and analysis with different guests and commentators and lawmakers. So tomorrow morning at this time, it's reaction to the State of the Union. Right now, it's On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And our number, if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our first caller is Katie in New Holstein. Hello, Katie.
Good morning.
Morning.
I love your show. I love this station. I just have several questions to ask Kevin. One thing, my husband and I are in our 70s, and we're going to sell our place in the country. We have a two-story home, 7.5 acres wooded, so we expect to get a nice price for it. I know the market is not very good now, but this is really a nice piece of property. But the thing is we don't want to own two homes. We're looking at homes now in like the $125,000 to $35,000 range. We want something small that we can keep up. And we're thinking, if we sell this place and have that money, what do we do with it? After we buy a home, we have money left over, what would be the best place to put it? And also, tax-wise, do we have, you know, is there any clue that he could give us that we save some money?
Hold on, Kate. We'll see what Kevin has to say.
Yeah, I can't wait. Oh, wait, that's me. Never mind. Kate, do you have a rough idea of what proceeds you might bring in for your home?
Well, we are having realtors look at it now, and we're having one come this afternoon, but we only have one that said between 135 and 100 or 235 to 40,000.
Okay. One thing you might want to look at as you're trying to assess the value of your home, realtors are always the, you know, the first place to turn to see what they think the place is worth and what they're willing to list it. But another thing I would look at doing is invest a few hundred dollars with an actual appraiser whom you would hire on your own, and especially one who does a lot of work for lending institutions, because just about anybody who looks at your place is going to probably get a mortgage for it, and especially if they listen to this show, and they are going to have to get the same response for it. So getting an appraiser to look at it and see what the appraiser will tell the bank about the appraiser's estimated value gives you a more realistic idea of its worth. And realtors can have some very good insight into what's going on in the housing market. But there are also, they can have a very wide range of opinion on what they think it might sell for. Some might try to tantalize you with a very high offer that you won't be able to get. And then you'll have to be disappointed when you lower the offer down to a level that's a little more realistic. Other ones will just want to try to get the thing done, so they'll encourage you to sell it for as low a price as possible to make sure the thing gets done quickly. But generally, those are the first place to turn, but I'd also think about an appraiser. The second thing about this, at that price range, you probably will not owe any capital gains taxes for it whatsoever. Most couples can exclude gains on their primary residence, married couples, for $500,000, so it's unlikely that you'll owe any taxes on it whatsoever. I will say this. It might be difficult for you to get a mortgage, and it might be uncomfortable for you to get a mortgage. So if you are going to pay cash for it, I do recommend that you do that. But I don't think you'll have a ton of money left over. The reason being is if you do find a place that you like, even in that $130,000 price range, chances are you're probably going to have to spend a little money to get the house just like you like it, whether it's decorating or changing a room around or something. Yeah, or maybe
we're figuring about $20,000 to $25,000 to, you know, bring it up to date from what we've looked at. So yeah, we still would have, you know. And also, I wanted to ask you about selling it ourselves rather than going with a realtor. My grandson is an attorney, and he could help us with the legal part of it. I'm just wondering if it's a good idea, if you're better off to just, you know, pay the price and go with a realtor.
If you have the inclination and you have an extra advantage that many people don't have of a relative who's willing or able to do that kind of work, you might want to try selling it yourself first. You'll either sell it and save yourself a bunch of money in commission for a lot of extra work on your part. Or you won't sell it at all, and you'll say, you know what, now I realize why realtors get paid what they do, so they'll go ahead and do it. One of the problems is, of course, is if you sell it too quickly, there's always a natural inclination to say, oh gosh, we should have held on longer, we should have raised the price higher. Once you get that appraiser's valuation of the home, that's probably going to be a pretty fair price for it, so that should be something that you expect and not a whole lot more. But if you're up for it and you really want to go through it, you might want to try it for a few months and see what kind of offers you get. But the advantage that realtors have is for better or for worse, they have all the information with easier access to them, so they're probably going to have more people coming through. Again, for better or for worse, means you have to keep the place up in shape, have more open houses, etc. But you might want to try it yourself and see what happens.
Well, maybe we can just give some general advice. Let's say somebody sells their home and has, you know, $50,000 or maybe $100,000 extra there. Is there just some sort of general tips as to what to consider what she should do with that money?
Yeah, if it's money that's needed, I would keep it as safe as you possibly can. Use long-term certificates of deposit, especially if you can find a decent one at a local institution, and also use those Series I bonds, which we've discussed before, savings bonds, which are generally fairly liquid and pay a decent interest rate right now. It'll be 3.06% through May 1st, I think that date is.
Thank you very much, Kate, for the call and for the kind words, and good luck to you. Sounds like an exciting adventure. Dick in Montfort is with us now. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I had a question about paying taxes twice on some money. I borrowed from an IRA some years ago, and I paid it back in the installments they asked for, and that included interest. The interest was split, I think it was something like it was 6% with 2% going to the company and 4% going back into my own account. When I cashed out the IRA, I had to pay taxes on the whole thing. And that seems to me I'm paying taxes twice on that amount, which was the interest. It really adds up, as a matter of fact, over the years to a couple thousand dollars that I think I shouldn't have had to pay in taxes.
Yeah, this actually, when you did the borrowing, Dick, it wasn't really an IRA. It was probably a company at work plan, like a 401k, right?
Right.
Okay. For better or for worse, your situation, you mean you paid fees back in based on the money that you borrowed, and then when you pulled it all out, it was all taxes income, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, that actually was correct. You, the extra money that you paid into the account represented an appreciation, if you will, of the account, even though it went in as an untaxable or a tax on something you couldn't deduct. I'd still say that this was the proper way to handle things, but it is one of the downfalls of borrowing money from a retirement account like this. I don't recommend that people do this unless it's an emergency, but if it's an emergency, you should do it. And but one of the downfalls is you do have to pay taxes on the appreciated money that you put into it as well.
Bummer, Dick. Sorry about that. Jeff in Clintonville is our next caller. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning to your knowledgeable guest.
Who's that?
Jeff, it's me, Kevin McKinley. I'm on today. I'm gone next week, but I'm here today.
I'm glad you said that, Kevin. Okay.
Okay. And thank you for the humor. I have a question about annuities. I see a lot of these commercials. You know, I don't need the cash now, but I'd like the cash now with less tax penalties. I have about $250,000 that I had in a deferred tax account. And I'll be retiring in a couple months, but I'll only be 57. And I always looked at that money as my kind of fun money until I looked at what I would be paying in a tax penalty. Then it wasn't so fun. It's like 20% for each amount that I would draw out. I transferred that money out of the market into a FDIC bank option just so the principal would be safe. And I'm wondering, do I have options for an annuity? And on that amount of money, what would be a typical monthly payout if I did go with an annuity?
If you take an annuity, and by annuity I think you mean like an immediate annuity, Jeff, where you would give the insurance company a bunch of money and they would send you a small check
right.
every single month, right?
Right.
Well, if you do an immediate annuity, that will not save you anything in taxes. All of that money will be taxed as ordinary income to you. You actually, and this is the sad state of affairs right now for people who want to do what you want to do, is if you go to immediateannuities.com, they have some calculators you can use to figure out what the payments might be for all the different scenarios that you might choose, but. Let's say you have $250,000 and you say, I want this money to last 10 years or 20 years or whatever. Divide the dollar amount out by how many months you want it to last, and that's about how much you're going to get because interest rates are very low right now, especially on safe money, which you would hope that the insurance company would invest this in safe money, and then the insurance company has to take their profit out of it. The extra income you get from this will actually be extremely low. What I would rather have you do is pull the money out with regard to what tax bracket you would actually be in when you pull it out. So you want to pull, I assume you're going to collect Social Security, right?
Well, that's part of the issue. I'm too young. I'll only be 57 when I retire in a couple months.
But eventually you will, at least at age 62, right?
I was thinking waiting to 66.2 because then if you look at the actual amount of the check, it almost doubles.
Yeah, it's a little higher. Of course, you're 4.2 years older and 4.2 years, sorry, but 4.2 years closer to death than you are if you were to take this at 62.
That's true, but I calculated my genealogy, and I'm probably good to about 86 or 87.
Wow.
Okay, and that's a good age, and that's not surprising. The most people on these calculations, when they come to me, they say, Kevin, should I take Social Security sooner or later? Should I take my state pension now or later? I'd say, tell me how long you're going to live and what you're going to need for money in between now and your death, and I'll tell you when you should take it. But otherwise, the general rule of thumb is if you have a life expectancy that exceeds about 78 to 79, generally it makes sense to wait. However, if this $250,000 or whatever it is, Jeff, is your sole source of funds, I would much rather have you draw sooner rather than later from Social Security, whatever other pension options you might have, and keep this money safe so that you can not only use it for an emergency, but also reinvest it if interest rates do go back up at a higher rate. And then okay. When you are pulling it out, are you single or married?
Married.
You're married. Okay. I'd like you to pull it out with attention to line 43 on your 1040, because that determines what federal income tax bracket that money will be taxed at. And for 2012, $70,700 on line 43 of your 1040 means you're at the 15% tax bracket or below. And so you share something in common with Mitt Romney.
Okay. But, we would be, we filed jointly, and we would be well above that level.
So. You will be well above that level on your gross income, I would guess, but that's typically about $90,000 to $95,000 of gross income. And then, and what you want to do is just manage the distribution so you can hopefully stay below that income bracket, however you possibly can. Don't take out any more than that if you can help it, and then always take out enough so that you just get up to the peak of that 15% federal bracket limit.
Well, Jeff, thanks for the call. Hope that helps, and happy retirement to you coming up. Time now for Smart Assets. For people who haven't refinanced their mortgages lately, Kevin, should they be in a hurry to get that done with soon?
They may, especially for a specific purpose, if they haven't done it lately or they haven't done it at all. Or they might want to wait. Rates keep dropping, so we're going to keep talking about it. I assume in about 4 years, God willing, we're still on the air and still talking about this, that, should I refinance? Mm-hmm. I can get 0% now at the local. Should I refinance? The 30-year rate was at 6% 3 years ago. It's down to about 3.85% or less. The 15-year was at 5% 3 years ago, and that's down to about 3.10% or less. And also, lenders are a little more lenient now than they might have been, say, a year ago. There is, however, one type of homeowner who should definitely reconsider financing right now, because that person probably hasn't done it recently.
Who might that be?
It's someone who wants to remodel their current home. These are generally people who have not refinanced. They've diligently paid down their mortgage down to nothing. But that that very frugal attitude has also meant they haven't updated their home in quite a while. And by the way, if you want to figure out if you do actually need to update your home, I have one very simple method to figure out if it's time to spruce the place up. Announce in a month that you're going to have a party, invite 100 people to it, and I guarantee you'll see things in your home, flaws, cracks, errors, dirty, dated items that you've never seen before in the 3 decades that you've lived there.
I resemble that remark.
Yeah, I know. I've gone through it. It's one of the reasons we don't have parties anymore, is because we don't want to keep remodeling the house all the time. 3 or 4 years ago, new home construction took up almost 2 times the amount of money spent on remodeling. And since about 2007 or so, it's been the exact opposite. About 2 times as much money is spent on remodeling versus new home construction. A lot of these people, like I said, won't refinance for other reasons. They don't want to have the payment. But if you do refinance and then use the proceeds to spruce the place up, you can enjoy it right now. And plus, in theory, you're actually adding value to the home that you currently own.
So how do you suggest remodelers go about refinancing?
Most people want to do this by tapping a home equity line of credit, or they want to get a smaller home equity loan. I would say no. Go with a full whole hog. The standard on your money advice for mortgages applies. Get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage for as much as the lender will allow, and that's usually about 80% of the loan to value. You can pay off the old mortgage with that money and then use the proceeds for remodeling. And I've done this now for 24 years almost for people. Everyone also always says, oh, well, we're only going to spend $30,000. And when I check back 6 months later, $30,000 is always $50,000. So just assume you're going to spend a lot more than the original estimate on the remodeling. Any remaining amount you have left over from the new mortgage can be used to pay off any other debt that you have, like credit card loans, pay for upcoming bigger expenses like purchasing a new vehicle, saving money for retirement or for college, for a family member, or for paying uncovered health care costs. And finally, if you have any money left over, you might want to just put it in a certificate of deposit. Discover Bank right now offers, a 10-year CD at 2.5%. Very safe bank, very nice CD. So, yeah, you're going to lose a little bit in the interest, but that money is going to be there for you if you need it in the future.
And what did you mean about waiting to get a new mortgage?
There are a couple things coming down the pike here. We've referred to them before, and we'll let you know when they're actually law. But there are two programs in place which may allow certain borrowers to refinance their home even if they are underwater on the mortgage or they're in tougher financial straits. One is this $25 billion settlement that the government is making with several of the larger banks which improperly filed mortgage documentation. Part of that is probably going to be either a rebate to borrowers who were affected, or they're going to give some kind of a cash bonus back, or both. And then also the Fed is going to probably try to put some program in place where people who are underwater, can't refinance their mortgage because they owe more than the home is worth, can actually get a write down on that and then get a better interest rate as well. However, that said, if you are in any mortgage situation at all, you definitely want to start walking down the road sooner rather than later, because even if you wanted your mortgage tomorrow, it still takes at least 4 to 6 weeks to do all the paperwork, get the new appraisals, go through the credit history, etc. So start doing it now. You can always stop when it comes time to sign your name on the dotted line.
And if you have a question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Tim in Hill Point. Hello, Tim.
Actually, it's Tom. Good morning.
Oh, I'm sorry, Tom. Go ahead.
Is it possible, Kevin, to buy a rental condo / second home and hold it in an IRA?
It's possible. The question of, is it a good idea to do it?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Are you concerned about gains that are going to occur within the property, and you don't want to pay taxes on it for the time being?
I'm not concerned about it, but I'm curious to know how the gains would work, whether it's from rental income or an appreciation of the value of the property.
Yeah, the trick is not – the hard part is not actually getting it bought within the account. It's more about finding a custodian who is on the up and up and willing to do it. Most custodians, like, you know, your larger financial services companies, won't touch these with a 10-foot pole because of all the details and drawbacks of doing it and then reporting on the value for it. But there are some custodians, some smaller ones, who have sprung up, and that's their sole mission, is to serve people who want to purchase real estate within the jar of the IRA. But I would tell you that it's going to be very difficult if you want to use the property for any write-offs, for tax breaks, which is a common desire of people who purchase this kind of property. It's much more difficult to do while it's inside the IRA. So I would tell you, if you are going to do this, I would not only do it outside of the IRA, but I would borrow the money to do it so that you can keep your cash flow up while you're trying to either rent it out or fix it up, or even when you do go to sell it. But I'd strongly advise against it, unless, again, you have Mitt Romney's IRA and you have between $6 and $20 million in that IRA, then you might want to tap that.
I grasp it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Tom, for the call. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. And if you have a question about personal finances, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
My mama told me you better shop around. Oh, yeah,
so, do you shop online? Kevin has some tips on how to shop online safely during this segment of the program. The more you shop online, the more you might be worried that your private account information could be compromised. And Kevin, I saw some headlines in the news that indeed is happening.
About once a month, a large database is hacked into and the information is stolen. This time it was from the online shoe retailer Zappos.com, which a fine provider and everything, but it's not a question with many of these outfits. If your information will be taken, it's when. Millions of passwords and email addresses were stolen, and not the credit card information in this particular instance, but the hackers might try to use the account information so that they can gain access to your other accounts, like your Facebook or your email accounts or whatever, and they also might try to get you to verify payment information or actually actually enter your credit card data. And they'll usually do that by actually sending you an email, what they call phishing with a PH, of trying to get you to turn over information that they need to take more money from you.
So what should we do to protect ourselves?
The first way is, if you do have any kind of notice of this whatsoever, change all of your account and password information immediately, and especially if you're using that password in other types of accounts, like a password or a banking account or another online financial institution. When you are setting up an account and using a password, make sure it's as strong as it possibly can be. It should be very long. It should be nonsensical. It shouldn't be password. It shouldn't be hello. It shouldn't be 1234. You're better off using something that has many different kinds of digits and characters, like symbols or numbers or punctuation marks, and use a different password for each site. Now, Microsoft says that the average computer user has about 25 different accounts that require passwords. One way that you can keep the passwords different, but remember them, is to use a base nonsensical phrase like BR ampersand exclamation point 73 and then the name of the site you're at, like a 5 or 6 digit password, and then Facebook or something, so that you know where you're at and you know that it's different from your other sites. There's a fine provider called LastPass, LastPass, at LastPass.com. They have a free service that manages all your passwords for you, and there's a premium site that costs about $1 a month.
Yeah, I'll have to check into that, because I like that tip about the same base password, because I forget these passwords for all these different sites. And
we discussed about the declining, the longer you live, yes. the more your brain erodes and evaporates. And boy, I'll tell you what, I can barely find out where my car keys are now, much less where the, what my 28-digit password is for my Twitter account.
Right. So let's say I've done that. Now what?
Now you should protect your computer. Don't click on any suspicious emails whatsoever, or open any files. None of these institutions will contact you and say, hey, can you click here and verify this or look at this attachment? What you should do is hover your cursor over the link that they're asking you to click on, and then look down in the lower left-hand corner of your browser, and you'll see what the actual address of the site is. Even if it looks like there's a name like Citigroup or Citibank in the address, you're better off logging out of your own account, going directly to the site, and then logging in that way rather than clicking through on the link. You should definitely have virus and malware protection on there. Microsoft, if you're a Windows user, has some pretty good free updates for their virus and malware protection. And then Mac has a free product called ClamXAV.com that you can use to protect against Mac viruses, little though they may be. And we're going to be talking more about some other programs you can use to protect your computer.
Yeah, what if you're, besides protecting your computer, what if you're worried about protecting your own financial information?
You should freeze your credit report now. Privacy.wi.gov gives you some templates you can use to contact the credit bureaus. It costs $10 to freeze the report, another $10 to thaw it, and then another $10 to freeze it again, but it's well worth the cost to protect the hassle that comes about if someone steals your information. Some banks do allow you to pay for online purchases with disposable credit cards. These are cards that are good for limited use or one time, and then the number basically disappears. You should probably not store your credit card information in an account online, even if it's encrypted to your eyes. It might still be able to be seen by a hacker if they can get access to the database. And finally, you may want to look at getting a credit card or a bank account for online purchases only that has a very low balance, meaning there's only a few hundred or a few thousand dollars of either credit in there or available credit, so that if you do, worst case scenario, someone does clean the account out by getting online access to it, you don't lose that much.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have full lines now, but maybe time for you at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our next caller is Julie in Mequon. Hello, Julie.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I have a mortgage question for you.
Good.
Okay, so we currently have an ARM at 7.5%. And, we'd like to take advantage of the lower interest rates. We're thinking about putting our house on the market. But of course, there's no guarantee that we would sell our home. So would you say we should just go ahead and refinance now, pay the appraisal fee and refinance? And if the house sells, great. That's wonderful. We'd like to take advantage of the, you know, the lower cost of house right now too. So what would you suggest?
I would say you are much better off refinancing now and assuming that you won't sell the home and be pleasantly surprised if you do. The cost you pay for the appraisal fee, the closing costs, the points, whatever you pay, Julie, you're going to make that money up very quickly if you can get a mortgage rate that's closer to 4% instead of the 7%. And that's true if things just hold steady for now. If interest rates do rise, you will be so out of luck because of the higher interest rate you'll pay on your ARM that you'll really be hurting. So I would definitely go through all of the headache and hassle of getting the new mortgage, get a 30-year fixed rate for as much as the lender will allow, and pay it off as slowly as possible, not only because it does give you a lower payment for the time being and protect you from rising interest rate, but it also puts you in a position of strength if and when you do choose to sell the home, because if rates do rise, you're not only going to be paying more on the thing, but you're also going to have a less attractive pool of buyers from which to draw. And if rates do go down, great, you can always refinance and people will be more excited about paying more for your home. So yes, good question, but definitely go ahead and refinance now. And I hope that you know, your biggest problem is you get a ton of money for your current home and you can use it to go buy a different place.
That sounds great. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Julie, for the call. Good luck. Chris in Holman is with us now. Hello, Chris.
Hi, how are you guys today?
Very good. How are you?
Good. Love the show. Hey, I have a quick question, actually. I'm currently, I resigned from a position in which they had a pension plan. I was vested, and so right now if I don't touch it and I leave it alone at age 65, I'll have a guaranteed benefit of $340 a month. My other option is to pull out my personal contributions, which only amount to, I think, $5,000 or $6,000. To do with what I please at that point. So I kind of was just curious if that $340 guaranteed benefit is worth leaving alone or if I should pull it out and do something different.
The word guaranteed, Chris, if I had my way, the word guaranteed would be in quotation marks.
Okay.
Because there is no guarantee that it will be there, that it will be in that certain amount. I suppose if everything goes okay, it probably will be, but I'm not sure I'd want to take a chance on it. That said, if all you can get out of it is a few thousand dollars, at $350 a month, you're looking at, you know, maybe $4,000 a year. How old are you?
30.
Oh, yeah. This is a bet I would make. Unless you have a better use for that money, I would much rather have you say, you know what, I'm going to leave my money in there, and who knows, maybe I'll get it back every single year if they can actually manage this pension appropriately. Is it a private pension, or is it with a state pension provider?
It's a private pension.
Okay. I wouldn't count on it being there. I'd be pleasantly surprised having it there, but it is 35 years away. And again, unless you have some other need for money, that few thousand dollars could be better employed, right now, I'd much rather have you just take the bet and hope that it's get there. But do this. Make sure that you're constantly updating your address if you're moving to make sure that the information gets to you so that they can come and find you. A lot of people your age who 35 years ago were expecting this pension have moved and have forgotten about the pension, and they don't even know where the contact information is. So definitely keep that information close to hand and make sure they know where you are too.
Sounds good. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Chris. And good luck to you as well. Susan in Appleton is with us now. Hello, Susan. What's on your mind?
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm calling about financial planners in general. I recently inherited some money, and I have mutual funds and IRAs and everything in place. And then I inherited some stock as well. And I wanted to go to a financial planner who would help me plan with this money and not have the products of their own. Because I have my own products already. Is that a reasonable request to have someone help me plan with my money and using what I want to do?
It's a reasonable request. It's something that I definitely agree with. That's how I work with people. The good news for me and the bad news for you, Susan, is people like this are very difficult to find. For some reason, I don't know why, you know, people keep enrolling in law school all the time. Nobody ever wants to become a financial planner, a fee-based financial planner. Again, I thank the heavens above that people aren't interested in this. I'm guessing that sooner or later some network, you know, NBC or HBO is going to come up with some glamorous hour-long weekly drama about financial planning where the people are all 30 years old and really sexy and have a lot of interesting things going on in their lives.
It
does, yeah, oh, trust me, especially at this time of the year. I live a very glamorous life, as you can imagine. But until that happens and until people start getting interested in becoming financial planners, fee-based financial planners are very difficult to find. If you do have a tax person, you can ask like a CPA, you can ask that person if they can recommend anyone who is fee-based. You can also go to, it's NAPFA.org, NAPFA.org, and there's another one that the Financial Planning Association, and they have lists of people who do charge a fee basis alone. But again, even in the more urban areas of Wisconsin, it's very hard to find people. And just because the person pays fees, that doesn't necessarily mean they're better or worse than someone who charges on commission. But you sound very clear in what you're looking for. So if that's the case, I would go to those websites. And we'll have those up at onyourmoney.com later on today with a link to the search engine so you can at least see if there's someone close by who does that for you.
And you're saying that's what you do also. You're a financial planner. You don't have products that you have to get the people into, right?
No, I don't. And it's a choice I made a long time ago. I just charge people basically either by the hour, or if it's an ongoing relationship, I charge a percentage of the assets that I manage that we try to keep as low as we can. But again, there are other people out there who do this, and some of them I'm certain are better than I am. The question is, when you're trying to find the right person, you have to not only find the right personality match, but also if what they're charging you is worth what you're going to be paying them to you. And that's the only person it really matters to is if you feel like, hey, I'm paying this person X dollars, I got this out of it, I feel better, it's a good deal.
Susan, thanks for the call. Elena in New London is with us. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
I'm concerned because my husband and I have decided that we are going to divorce, but because I didn't work very much, all the assets are in his IRAs, and when it comes time for an asset division, is it possible that those IRAs could be, when they split, rolled over, for instance, to my name, or is it going to be the case that he'll have to withdraw money, pay the taxes and the penalties on those early withdrawals from the IRA, and then it gets split?
No, I'm sorry you're having to go through this, Elena, but the good news is that there are regulations and channels in place already for people in your situation to split up retirement accounts, roll them over into your own IRA, whatever the court decrees, and not have to pay any taxes on it. You actually have the money it's yours to do with what you wish. You have to pay taxes on it, obviously, when you pull it out, but that would be true whether you were married or separated. But no, the money can be split up under what's called a QDRO, that the money is moved from a retirement plan in his name into your name, depending on the court's instructions. And how long have you been married, Elena?
About 30 years.
Okay. I have other good news for you, is that was he the primary breadwinner in the family?
Yes.
Okay. Your attorney probably should have told you this already, but you also probably qualify for his Social Security benefits, the benefits that are rightfully yours but are based on his work history as well. So that should help you out in retirement also.
Yeah. Good luck to you, Elena, and I'm sorry you're going through this. We are running close to the end of the program here, Kevin. Time, though, for the website of the week.
Yeah, you can go to publications.usa.gov, and the new consumer guide has been put out, publications.usa.gov. There's like 100 and some pages in there. You can either order a copy for free, or you can look at it online in a Acrobat or PDF file. Publications.usa.gov, your taxpayer dollars paid for this, so you might as well enjoy it being free to you, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Sounds good. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with us just about every Tuesday at this time for information and advice on your money. Kevin will be off next week. He is taking some time off the radio program. We'll have another program about money matters at this time next week. But no, Kevin. And a reminder that tonight we have the State of the Union Address, President Obama delivering the State of the Union Address at 8 o'clock our time, and that is followed by the Republican response from Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels. live coverage from NPR tonight. And then tomorrow morning, we'll have all sorts of reaction and analysis on what was said about the state of our union. And you'll have plenty of opportunity to weigh in with your thoughts and views, too. That's tomorrow morning between 6 and 9 here on the Ideas Network. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.